Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast with your hosts, Rich Harden and Howard Young.
Good afternoon, Howard Young. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you, Rich?
Doing well. This one's a little earlier than we normally record, so I'm still at work, so I'm going to apologize to anyone if my new puppy begins to bark. I have moved him, but sometimes he can be a little noisy. So,
well, you know, I know we've had people don't want to hear about the weather, but we talked about the rain the other day. It has come east. We have been underwater for the last couple of days and with no end in sight.
Well, that'll be good for grass, though. You needed it.
I did. It's nice to have some rain during the summer. First day of summer, as a matter of fact.
Nice.
And today. It's typically tonight we have a guest that we're really both excited about. We've wanted to have on for a good while, and it's Pat Nolan. And without further ado, I'd just like to welcome him to the show.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation. Look forward to sharing with you all and hearing from you all.
Well, Howard said it pretty well, and I'm really, really happy to have you on, Pat. I know we don't know each other. We've never met, but I've followed you for several years. I've never heard anything bad, nor have I ever heard you say anything bad about anyone. And in the training business, that is a rare commodity. So I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come on and speak with us. I really, really do appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I enjoy being here again. I enjoy dogs and dog people.
So can you, I don't know if you get asked this kind of question very often, but can you give us a little bit of your history, how you got involved in this?
Yeah, in 1975, I got out of the Army, and I was in Denver, Colorado, and went with a girl to meet some of her friends, and I was petting her dog. I said, I miss having a dog. I'm going to get a dog now that I got out of the Army. And they said, I'll go talk to Gary upstairs. He's starting a guard dog company. And it was an old house made into two apartments, you know, in Denver, Colorado. And I went up and spoke to Gary, and he was starting a guard dog company. He worked at a kennel in Aurora, and he was starting a guard dog company on the side. I read Dick Keeler's book on guard dogs and started catching or agitating dogs the next day and fell in love with dog training. Went from there. I trained.
At 1975, is that what you said?
1975, yes. Yeah. Okay. And I started then, I got interested in Schutzhundsport and, of course, the tracking and the obedience and attending seminars and trying to figure out how to earn a living training dogs. I didn't want a real job. I wanted to train dogs. so turned into a real job. But I had a seminar in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Mike Jones told me that he thought you could earn a living training retrievers, that they were all in all good dogs and good people. And I didn't know anything about retriever hunting with retrievers or retriever field trial sports. In fact, I wasn't even a duck hunter or a bird hunter. And I got some books. I started reading books, went to see a field trial, and went from there. I fell in love with the dogs and the hunting. And I was very fortunate to be able to spend the better part of 30 years as a professional retriever trainer. And traveled competitions from Georgia to California to Canada, Northern Ontario, and had a lot of fun, trained a lot of dogs, learned a lot. At some point, I realized that we were going south in the winter. Well, I didn't realize we were going south, but we were going south in the winter for 3 months, and we'd follow the field trial circuit back up north to Maryland, and then I'd go to Canada or Vermont in the summer and then work our way back down. And I was on the road about 7 months a year, moving my family a couple times a year, and realized that my family was paying a pretty high price for what I wanted to do for a living. And so I quit running field trials and tried to figure out what I was if I wasn't a retriever trainer.
I was going to say, you already took a big jump from, you know, protection dog and Schutzen into the retriever world. How long did it take you to make that jump from when you spoke to the fellow in Denver, Colorado, to the next retriever person?
I'm thinking that it was probably 4 or 5 years before I started training retrievers. And I had my first e-collar before I trained retrievers. And you do need electronic collars. You know, they work at great distances, off leash at great distances. So that's where I learned my collar skills. And the, I think it was like 1978. So I had force trained dogs to retrieve before I got a retriever, and I had used electronic collars, and both of those came in very handy when I started training field dogs. So I started training hunting dogs first, and then gun dog competition, and then the big retriever field trials.
Can you, just for folks that listen that don't understand, can you kind of explain what the force retrieve is, please?
The dogs naturally want, you know, the retrievers, the bird dogs, retrievers, and often bird dogs means the pointing dogs, and the duck dogs are the retrievers. They naturally want to retrieve, but sometimes they don't naturally want to do it the way we want. They want to be rough on the bird, or they have, some of them want to eat the bird, or they want to go get one bird and you need to get a different one. To be able to put rules on the game of the retrieve for the dog, we teach a structured retrieve, a command. You have to pick up what I tell you when I tell you. You have to hold it when I tell you until I tell you to give it up. And you have to give it up when I tell you. And in the force retrieve process, it's a step-by-step process to teach a structure so that the dog understands a way you can put pressure on him, that he knows what he's doing right and what he's doing wrong.
So
the mechanical steps of training a retrieve.
With retrievers, was that typically a toe pinch?
I've seen toe pinch done. I've never done it myself.
Okay.
I didn't care for the mechanics of it, and I didn't like the aesthetics of it, the way it looked to me. Not that, you know, the picture is necessarily how we choose our training techniques. I like to, saying, you know, I have a lot of sayings. You collect them. The older you get, the more you collect. One of them is, if we don't understand the principles, we will be a slave to techniques. And the principles of how a dog learns, once we understand them, we can choose techniques to fit the dog, to fit the new approach, you know, depending on the animal and the skill we have to train. Uh-huh. But the way I've seen the nerve hitch or the toe hitch done, it didn't look to me like it translated, made a lot of sense to the dog. When we use a leash, it provides directional information with the pressure. So you're using a leash to pull the dog in or to correct the dog for not coming. It's demonstrating to the dog, showing him what he needs to do to turn that pressure off.
Right.
Same with sit or down. It's giving directional information. With the e-collar, it doesn't give any directional information. Here, sit, down, fetch. It all feels the same. And so we have to condition or teach him how to respond appropriately. Ear pinch, force fetch is the same. When we pinch his ear, he doesn't know how to respond, and it doesn't provide directional information. But because the pressure in your hands right there at his head, you can provide directional information and show him the way to turn this off is to grab the dumbbell, which is right in front of you. Now, and then you can guide his head as you reach out if he refuses. So we can give directional information when we're using the ear pinch, because I hold the collar and his ear. The nerve hitch on the toe, it doesn't look to me, again, not that people are bad if they use it, but it looks to me like the dog is really kind of just lashing out, and he finally bites something, and then you stop hurting him. And it's not as smooth for me as the ear pinch.
Right. I gotcha. My first Rottweiler was a great, great big Rottweiler, but he had about zero retrieve drive, zero prey drive for a toy. And we basically conditioned him to pick up the dumbbell using a forced retrieve with a pinch collar and a leash.
Mm-hmm.
And very effective to see that dog go from not really having any desire to pick up a dumbbell to actually do it with enthusiasm and speed. It was impressive.
Yes. And again, that's not to say nerve hitch is bad or wrong or immoral or any of that. It just, I think the ear pinch is smoother. I think that pinch collar is a smoother approach too.
So from protection dogs, retriever dogs, 30 years, when you finally decided that you want to do something different, where did you land?
Well, when I stopped running field trials, I finished a college degree. I got a bachelor's degree in business organization. I'm not very organized, and it's not a ton, but and I trained gun dogs, and I was coaching people that were training their own hunt test dogs. So I did a lot of coaching, and then the military approached me. And, you know, at one point I was kind of discouraged. I thought, golly, I spent 30 years getting good at retriever training, and now I'm not going to use it, you know, and I start all over at something else. And in fact, I didn't start all over. I just got opened up doors, and I was able to use those skills that I'd learned in detection work and also in directional work with the military.
Well, very cool. Well, you know, our Howard mentioned it earlier. A lot of our guys are out there. You know, they don't have a in-house trainer, or they're limited. So, if you don't mind, just kind of describe a directional process for people and what directional. You know, for us, we were teaching dogs to go somewhere to search for, you know, a narcotic or an explosive. Obviously, you know, for us, it was always explosives because it's, we don't want to be there. We want to be at distance, right? So,
yeah.
Can you kind of explain the process for me? What kind of we're talking about with directionals?
Sure. To handle a dog to an unknown target, maybe there's a car at a distance, but so often there's more than one car. So there's lots of potential targets out there. To handle the dog, to send him from your side out to a distant target, they have to do at least three things. They have to go when we send them. They have to stop when we tell them, but not until we tell them. And then they have to change direction on command. And then they have to know a task when they get there, whether it's, as you said, the detection task, or it's with a camera. You're going to direct him around for reconnaissance, or placing a listening device. So he has to have a skill at the end, but then three things: go, stop when we tell you, but not unless we tell you, and change directions. It's complicated enough. If we try to teach that at once, he doesn't know what he's doing right and wrong. If you correct him, he doesn't know what it was for. If you praise him or reward him, he doesn't know what he did right. So we break that into three distinct steps, teach each step individually. So we teach to go and pick out a target and go to it. Know you can get paid there. Pick out a target and go to it. Know you can get paid there. We're teaching the dog to change directions in front of you. Go left, go right, go straight. Go left, go right, go straight. And then we're teaching the dogs, once they know to go well, we teach them to stop en route. And then we would combine them. So it would be go and stop, and then go and stop and change directions. And then we put it together in a drill called single T. If you draw it out on paper, it looks like a T. The handler's at the bottom. There's a pile at the top, and then two over piles. So you'd send them through. You stop in the middle, and then kind of like a baseball diamond, stop in the pitcher's mound and send them to first base or second base or third base, and then send from home plate to second base. Then you send through and stop at the pitcher's mound again, change directions again. It's called single T. And the drills, this isn't a drill that I developed or anything. It's widely used in retriever sports. The difference in individual programs probably has to do with the balance of reinforcement or reward and pressure. There's two reasons a dog does anything, I believe, and he wants to make something desirable happen or good happen, and he wants to make something undesirable or something bad stop. So there's two reasons he goes when we send him. He knows he can make, he said, there's a bumper out there for me, or there's a tug out there for me, or my Kong is out there. And I bet he's, you know, you keep good, good, good. He says, ah, that's where it is. So he's running out to get his Kong. He's running out to get paid. And also we teach him a pressure response, a command response. When I say go, now's a good time to want to go. So all those commands are taught for both the positive reinforcement of this, the pull. We try to pull the behavior from the dog with his desire for reward, and then we push with pressure for the same behavior. If we only use the push, he's just a prisoner, really. They're not applying their own skills. You know, the chain gang, they're picking up trash on the side of the road because there's a guy in a van with a radio and a gun. You know, you can't outrun both of them. And so he only works while the guy is there. And if the only reason your dog is performing an action or a behavior is because he thinks there could be unpleasant if he doesn't,
he will stop when he realizes you can't apply the pressure here, or he's too great a distance, or your battery's dead, or, you know, he doesn't see you, you know. But when we want the dog to apply all his own skills, we draw the behavior from him with the desire for reward, and then we push for it also. So,
a great explanation. Thank you. That helps folks that, you know, we've had several people write in and or contact Howard especially and say, hey, you know, this information is so valuable because we just don't get to hear it. So I really appreciate you explaining that. I really do. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll tell you what stands out to me, and it's when I know that we're really talking to a real trainer, is when there's no room for anthropomorphic thinking. You know, you're talking about, you know, what a dog desires, and I really like that, to make something desirable happen, or to make something unpleasant stop. I mean, those are pretty basic principles, but people tend to cloud a lot of their philosophy with human emotion, and there's no room for any of that, really.
I try to evaluate training from the dog's perspective.
So I attended a workshop that you did in Georgia for the Georgia Police Canine Foundation.
It's been
a few years. You demoed a female lab. I think she was about 8 years old at the time. And I tell you what, you absolutely blew us away, because you showed us some things. And this is kind of what, before we started recording, I was talking about, is that if all you ever experience is basically your own little box of things, and you don't get out and you see what's possible, you really opened my eyes in terms of what could be possible in terms of sending the things that you did with her were, I know I wasn't the only one there that was just like in awe in terms of her motivation, just the direction that she was willing to travel away from you. I would say that we become, as police dog trainers, we become very consumed with how do we get the dog back? Most exercises involve getting your dog to come to you. Of course, they're motivated to go after prey. That's not an issue. Getting them back is typically what we focus our energies on. What I saw her do in terms of running out away from you was just phenomenal. And once you got there, you were able to give her direction through a device that she could hear your commands on a microphone. And she would pan left, pan right, sit down, whatever you wanted her to do at an incredible distance. So that was something that just really blew us away.
It amazes me. It amazes me. They will take direction at great distance and the drive to go out and do. And then just the retriever sports, the dog's taking hand signals and whistle commands. They're working now at 400, 500, 600 yards sometimes when the conditions are right. You know, if the wind's in your face, they're probably not going to hear a whistle from 600 yards away. If he's crashing through corn or brush and the wind's in his face, he's not going to hear it that far away. But when the conditions are right, they can hear commands at extreme distances. But when you take it outside of that and you add the radio and then some kind of camera on the dog where you can see what the dog sees, mm-hmm. or like a drone up above and you can see the dog. So if you can see the dog or see what the dog sees and they'll take directions on the radio, there's really only limited by your training time and imagination how far away you can work the dog.
I would say, as impressive as that was, the one thing that you did that just really was really astounding was you talked about the dog delivering a package to a door. And obviously it would be something that a dog could carry. So you're able to send the dog to the door. And then you said, well, do you want it delivered on the hinge side or the doorknob side?
Yeah.
Pretty precise. Because if it's on the hinge side, the person has to come outside the door to get the package.
Yes. Yeah. Depends on what you want. Depends on what you want. Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah. They can... they're useful in the hostage situation. They're delivering packages. They've been used to plant listening devices, recording devices. They can retrieve them later. They're really very versatile. And the platform with a camera, putting a dog through to clear a building. You know, after a call out, somebody has to go first.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a man or a woman.
So in your e-collar instruction, you also if I remember correctly, like we were using some raised platforms and we were sending dogs to the platform, and we were using low level as they moved away from us. So the dog learned to shut that pressure off by moving away. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Yes. And again, I think that's a component that's missing from a lot of folks that use e-collars.
I think,
Rich.
I'm a little, say it again. I'm a little confused about what you said. I might have missed it. You cut out a little bit on me.
Let's say you're sending your dog to a place on a raised platform. You would apply a little low level pressure as the dog leaves you. Mm-hmm. And then the pressure would go away once the dog arrives at the platform, or perhaps on the way, if the dog understands that's where he's supposed to go.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem is you said, especially in law enforcement, we're always so concerned about getting the dog back. You know, and I know the military program that I was able to work with, the first thing we taught with the e-collar was to go away from us, was to go to that pile or go to that place board to teach them that all the fun's out there, you know, and then mm-hmm. come back and take directions. And so, yes, I completely agree with you. A little bit of pressure, turn it off by going out there. It's a great, great tool. Seen a couple of Pat's videos, especially running by everybody, going around the side of a house into a backyard. I saw that video. That is, if folks haven't seen that video, just knowing that you can accomplish that with a dog is very, very impressive. It was really, really nice work.
Thank you. When we talk about the collars, often the thing that comes to mind, I believe people think about the collar for correction. Correct. I want to stop this behavior. I'm going to stop this problem. We're going to fix this. And if we look at sort of I guess maybe it's clinical or classroom or scientific explanation of quadrants. You know, they talk about training in the four quadrants. There's mm-hmm. four different consequences we need to control to train the dog. Mm-hmm. Two of those consequences increase behavior. Two of the consequences decrease behavior. We can use positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement to increase behavior. Positive punishment, negative punishment to decrease behavior. Now, positive punishment means not that he likes it, but that we add something. So correct. Most of the time, often, the initial thought or use people reach out for a collar is because the dog is doing something they don't want or they don't like or they want not to stop. And if we major in stopping behavior, stop that. Soon, when we put the collar on the dog, he just knows I got a butt whooping coming. And maybe you've seen him. You put a collar on him, they lay their ears back. They kick right out of drive right now. And he says, oh, I need to be very careful here. And the dog can't do his best work in that frame of mind, in that mindset. He's certainly not going to be detecting odors, difficult odors in that mindset. He's not going to be giving his full energy. So for a dog to be fully engaged in the work, I believe the collar needs to be used for both pushing for behavior and stopping behavior, and primarily pushing behavior. I'm going to guess somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 or 95% of the pressure I put on a dog with an electric collar is to push for desired behavior rather than to stop something that I don't want.
Wow. That's complete opposite of what most people do without having been given instruction.
Unfortunately, I think the e-collar becomes, instead of a teaching tool, it's a gut punch tool. It's I'm going to stop this behavior, but they don't teach with it. And it should be a learning tool to teach the dog, hey, the faster you get out here, the faster this little bit of pressure goes away, and everything out there is really, really good.
Yeah.
That's missed a lot in training.
And if we, a couple little side notes on e-collar conditioning here at your collar training. Howard, you mentioned that we're using a low-level pressure. A trainer on the West Coast, Tony Enchenis, said one time in a conversation, I don't know if he says it a lot or says, but I just heard it one time. He said, there's only three settings on your collar, no matter what your collar says. Like the Dogtra goes 0 to 127, mm-hmm. Tritronix goes 1 to 7 or 8, and it's, I guess, Garmin now. It was Tritronix once upon a time. That's how old I am.
You are dating yourself.
But, But no matter what the caller says, there's really only three settings. It's like Goldilocks. There's not enough, too much, and just right. And if it's not enough pressure, the dog is, it's not enough to motivate him to respond, to turn it off. And that's teaching him to put up with it then. And if we use not enough pressure, we're conditioning him to need more pressure to change his mind. Right. If we use too much pressure, they can't think and process. And there's a lot of negative backwash from, you know, just overwhelming him. You know, you don't have to drop a concrete block on my foot to get me to loosen my shoelaces. You know, if the laces are just a little tight, I'm going to loosen them up because it feels better, you know. And so the same with the dog. We don't have to, you know, clobber him to get him to move. And if we're using the pressures appropriately, I believe over time it takes less and less pressure to change his mind. And not he's getting hardened to it and he has more and more and need more and more. Let's get a second collar on him now because one doesn't work anymore. And, you know, the first thing I teach the dog, I ask him a question. Can you feel that? When he says, hey, I can feel that, then I teach him when you move, it goes away. When you move, it goes away. And the rest of his life, I just show him different ways to turn it off.
So describe when you say you ask him the question, obviously you're looking for a behavior. What behavior in the dog are you looking for that gives you the answer to that question? Hey, folks, we're proud to have Hold the Line Canine Conference as a supporter and sponsor of the Working Dog Depot podcast. Joe Lukowski and staff are already securing vendors and presenters for the seminar in April. That's April 9th, 10th, and 11th in a brand new location. That's right, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We are especially excited about that. It's going to cut our travel time in half, and there's nothing like being in the Carolinas in early April. Let's Hold the Line Canine Conference. We're very much looking forward to being there and hope to see you all there. Thank you.
I put him on a loose leash, and he's walking around investigating the environment, and I don't want to start in a real highly exciting spot. I wouldn't go to a yard where we do our bite work all the time necessarily. You know, you go in there and he's fired up, he's jacked up, he's looking for somebody. But you just a new spot, he's relaxed and just looking around investigating. And I just tap and tap and I keep raising it every time I tap. I start like at a zero and just keep raising it. And I'm not looking for a particular behavior, but just some kind of response that indicates he felt it. Like some of them will look over their shoulder. Sometimes the ear will twitch or they stop and step back, you know, just some kind of response in the dog that he felt it, not a particular behavior, but just some indication that he felt it, an indication, not a response, but an indication that he felt it. All right. And then I use that. I put a little leash pressure on him to guide. And I use that bump, bump, bump. As soon as he moves, I stop, do that a few times. And then I show him lots of different ways to turn it off.
When, I don't know how much of this you can actually talk about, but the request from the military, were they specific initially with what they wanted from you?
The very first call I got was from it was called a commander's challenge from the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And they didn't go into great detail because the project was classified, but their first question was, it was kind of fun. Their first question, Let me put some background out first. Let me back up a little bit. The first project I did before, I had been thinking about, somebody had mentioned that the Israelis were doing directional work with radios or some way. And they were asking me, how could I direct a dog without using a voice and hand signals? So I had been thinking about it for a couple of weeks. And because I was not running the field trial circuit, I was experimenting and looking around, how do people make a living training dogs? And I had been on some discussion boards on the internet. I mean, you know, how are people making a living training dogs? And I was doing some demonstration work for Dogtra. I represented them at some shows and I liked their collars. That rheostat, they're very adjustable and very reliable. And to do to trade shows, I put some tricks on the dogs, you know, I'd finish a bottle of water and accidentally knock it off the counter. And I'd ask the dog, hey, throw that away for me. And they'd grab it and run down the hallway and put it in a trash can, you know, just to draw some attention to the booth. And I had been training a few tricks the shape sorter, you know, the little children's toy, the shape sorter,
yes,
where the rings are get smaller as it goes up. And my sister gave me one time. I came in from training, stopped at her house, and she said, here, I saw a dog do this, figure it out. So I taught a dog to stack the rings on a ring stacking toy. And when these guys called from the Air Force, they had been challenged. There are two different groups trying to solve a problem. And the question they presented to me was, they asked, well, they said, we've been calling around, and this is a group from Ohio. We've been calling around. Several people have asked us, said that we should talk to you, that you like to do different stuff. And can you train a dog to put a package on a target from 100 meters away? And if you can, how long will it take to get ready, and how much will it cost us? And I had already taught this dog directionals for the field and for hunting, so she would handle it long distances. And I taught her to put something in a trash can for the trade show. So my response was, if you just want to see it, I can show you tomorrow and it won't cost you anything. And I filmed it the next morning. We put a bucket out 100 yards away. They were talking in meters. I was talking in yards, but we put a camera in the middle. I put something in her mouth. I sent her out. Bucket. She dropped it in the bucket and came home, and we showed them the video. I don't know how we transmitted the video to them, but we got hired for the job, and it was a little more complicated than that in the long haul as it ran out, and we had to do it at night. So it was a fun project. It was challenging. I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. I had a good time. And while we were there, the challenge was done in a competition at Fort Campbell. 5th Special Forces Group had just started the multi-purpose canine program. And I met the trainers and the handlers at their kennel program when they were just getting started. Their dogs were living in temporary kennels. I mean, they didn't even have a kennel yet. You know, the program had just started. And I met them while we were doing the competition for this Air Force project. And, you know, we hung out for a day. And then they said, show us what you're doing. I asked the Air Force guys, and they said, fine. And when I showed them, they said, well, we got to work together. So that's how I got into the SF groups, and it started expanding from there.
Wow. Very good.
So it was fun.
I'm sure it was. Definitely a change of pace. I feel like I should definitely ask you about falconry. I know that you've got experience with birds, too.
Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, do you have specific questions or?
No, I think that they're, I would say, and maybe I'm wrong, I'd say the vast majority of people have no clue of what can be done with a bird. Especially, I think those of us that work primarily with dogs, where there are certain aspects that you can kind of make a dog do something. And obviously with a bird, you can't make a bird do it. You can't issue a correction on a bird, at least the kind of tactile correction that we're accustomed to. So I don't know if you could tell a little bit about what
sure.
you do or what you've done with that.
Sure. When I was a kid, somehow or another, I read a story. Maybe it was My Side of the Mountain. I know I read that one, but it's a great book, My Side of the Mountain. It was written by one of the sisters of the Craighead brothers. And if you remember, well, I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember, but they were in Life magazine. They went to India and hunted with a prince, and they wrote a book or two, and they became naturalists, and they worked with grizzlies and stuff out west when they grew up. But I fell in love with the idea of falconry. So I read everything I could get in the school library and then the town library. And I wanted to, there was no licensing required at the time. I found a magazine. I wanted to buy a harpy eagle. It was the biggest bird in there. And bird was probably bigger than me. My parents rightly said no. And later on, when I had a retriever training kennel there, and I was maybe 25 or 30, must have been 25, we were on the side of a mountain, and the birds would migrate south. And we had a Cooper's Hawk. I had a young Cooper's Hawk get caught in my bird pens. And I took him to the vets and tried to get him healed up. And I ended up meeting a rehab falconer who was also a licensed hunting falconer. And he became my sponsor. And I trained a number of red-tailed hawks, and then I raised a Cooper's Hawk from we took one from a nest as a young bird. And I flew Harris Hawks, Kestrel. What I would do is I'd train the bird in the fall and then hunt it and we trapped a bird. I didn't like raising the babies. I would trap adult birds. They have to take the first year birds, and we train them to follow. I would train them to follow me. Come to me first and then follow me. And you beat the bush and he follows you from tree to tree, and they come down and catch rabbits or birds if you're lucky, but primarily rabbits with the red tails. I trained a bunch and had a lot of fun. And really, I did fundamentally change how I trained dogs because of an experience I had with the hawks. I'm flying a peregrine falcon now, and I'll toss out some thoughts on that too later. But it took me about 4 to 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks, to take a wild bird and train them so I felt comfortable turning them loose. I'm not going to suggest that that's right or wrong. Some people do it a lot faster, some maybe longer. Sometimes you turn them loose and they fly away. I never had that experience, but it took me about 6 or 8 weeks, I guess. And after I'd flown a few, I was always trying to get more and better for my birds, as I am with my dogs. And I had one young bird that I had trapped in the fall. And I just knew after about 2 weeks' work, this rascal was loose, ready to fly free. So I took him out and I turned him loose and he flew up in a tree and I called him and he came back. I did that several times and I went to put him away and go get my dogs out and go training for the day. I would train my hawks in the morning, train hawks during the day. And then if I had one, I would hunt the hawks in the evening. So I was all puffed up and feeling proud of myself. You know, I'm a bad mamma jamma. I've trained this wild animal. And in 2 weeks, he came off leash. And then I got to thinking about some of the Labradors I had in training, and some of them wouldn't come unless I made them. And I thought, what have I done wrong? That I've taken a Labrador who's bred to want to work with you and taught them not to like working with me. And yet my hawk, now, don't get me wrong. I was making a living training and I was winning enough at field trials that people were sending me dogs. My truck was full and I was successful at field trials. But I realized that up until that point, I had just been trying to get better and better at the things I was doing. And because of that experience with the hawk, I realized I needed to learn new things to do, not just get better at what I was doing. And I started, and then I learned about training and drive and using reward markers. And I really started studying, learning, and how animals learn, how people learn, how we process memories. And I'm a much better dog trainer because of that experience with that hawk.
That's awesome. I think that's, if I had a desire for any trainer out there, it would be along those lines, because I had, although that's a pretty dramatic experience and it's great epiphany. I had and I've used that, the seminar that I went to that you did in Georgia that same year. I went to several others, and each one of those trainers was using conditioned reinforcers and markers. And up until that point, I really had not at all. It was still very much, it's funny you mentioned the book, the Kaler book. I've got it up here on the shelf. That was one of the first books that I read as well. And
still a good book.
Yeah, it is. A good book.
There's good information there. Yes.
There is good information. But I think that beginning to understand conditioned reinforcers and the value of food and reward, and that changed things for me a lot as well. And I think it does for any trainer that really will give it an honest shot and embrace it. It did for you too, right, Rich?
Oh, absolutely. You know, what you just described, Pat, is what I think every trainer, you know, if you're actually trying to become a lifelong learner of your craft, you know, student of your profession, it's in those moments that, you know, that epiphany that you get to have is like, okay, this is a bird that doesn't, you know, brain is very small, you know. And I just did this in 2 weeks, and it's up in a tree, and it came back, and I don't have a leash on it. So this animal that's supposed to have a relationship with us, how can I not do that as well? And that's a great learning lesson. I think, you know, all the successes that I've ever had, if you call it success, has been from those moments that you go back and you go, you know, I need to rethink how I'm doing things, and not so much. I've never been in a camp, whether it's political camps or dog training camps. I want to do the best for my dog and the best for our relationship, to say, hey, how can I better do this? How can I do this on a business level? How can I best help my clients improve their relationship with their dog? And it's not by a lot of compulsion and force. It's by teaching them how to build a relationship and putting in the work, and that it is a true time spent endeavor, because, you know, are you really ever done training your dog? You know, I think, you know, as an obedience training company that we are, they get caught up in results sometimes. And while you will see fast results in the first couple of weeks, it's what you do after training that makes the relationship and life better at home through maintenance and continued training and stopping those unwanted behaviors as they creep back up, because they will. You know, if you are not working with your dog, you do 4 or 5 days, you'll see a little chink in that armor again. And if you don't address it then you're going down that path of another problem. So I think that's a great experience to teach people that, hey, you know, there's all kinds of ways to do this. And when you have that moment in time to help you just become that learner to say, oh, I can do this here too. What a great experience.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. And Howard, you said rightly so that we can't really correct the birds, but we can, at some level, we can control the consequences of their actions, where the falcon, I want her to go up and circle above, get high and get altitude, and then dive down on prey that we produce. And if she's not following me, I've been planting birds in training. I put birds in launchers in training. And if she's not going as high as I'd like, or she's not following me, I flush birds in positions where I don't think she can get them, to kind of punish her, you know, to say, hey, you know, there's no action back there. You need to be higher. You need to, you know, or if she sits in a tree, what I don't like, I walk away or flush a bird a long ways out that she won't be able to get. And so negative outcome for her actions, but direct application of pressure on the birds. No, they don't take it. They don't take that. Yeah. But you know, one thing was freeing to me that I learned from the Hawks, that I changed, again, training and drive, and started me on the path to learn about markers and that, but also a mindset where I used to think, I'm going to make him do this, I'm going to make him do that. And when I realized I can't make the dog do anything, it was really freeing for me and for my dog. I said, hey, brother, you do whatever you want. I don't care, but I control the consequences. I think over time you will want to do it my way, but you do whatever you want. And you know, if they do the right thing, good stuff happens. If they do something I don't like, they're not getting what they want. We try to control that so they don't get what they want from behavior we don't want. And we just keep at it. If we control the consequences, they're going to end up doing what we want, if they're capable, you know, if we're working with the right animal. So that was freeing for me emotionally. You know, used to be some conflict, some tension between me and dog. Hey, you're on your own, brother.
Yeah. Conflict is probably the biggest thing that people struggle with.
Yeah.
I would agree. So Pat, you just mentioned, if I get the term as, I lost my train of thought there. I apologize. The picking the right dog.
Yes.
What does that look like?
What do you look for in a dog?
Yeah.
Let's back up. Executive functions, you know, the executive functions, and they talk about in human beings, there is a set of skills that they label executive function skills. And they're realizing that good executive functions are a better predictor of success in life than the high IQ. And one of these executive functions would be working memory. You have to have a good working memory to, you know, to manipulate things and remember, you know, why did I come in here? What am I doing? And you have to, you know, so working memory, attention, focus, and self-control, then mental flexibility. And I think in that set, of course, we need then drive to do the work. But, you know, no matter how drivey he is, if he can't focus, it's no good. If the most committed dog in a fight, it doesn't matter if you can't redirect him, if he's not malleable enough that you can redirect him, or you say, well, that's a wonderful thing and we're going to bite them all, but we got to do this first, you know, and then we'll go bite them, or, you know, hey, let's bite him, but we got to bite this guy first. You have to be able to direct him, to channel him. So in the retriever sports, it doesn't matter how much they want to retrieve. If they can't wait until you release them, they don't have the ability to wait. So if I have a chance to kind of evaluate, I like to see those things in a dog. If I'm buying a puppy and I know departments in military programs, they're not buying puppies as a general rule because it's too long. You know, we need to fill a slot in a class next Thursday. We can't buy a puppy and raise him up to fit that bill. But when I buy a puppy, I pick by pedigree. When I buy an adult dog, I try to evaluate, look for those skills, executive function skills, and drive, and then environmental stability. It's the same thing everybody else wants in a dog, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
It's funny because I see examples of working memory all the time, and I don't know that it was something that I really gave a whole lot of thought to. I think it was Cameron Ford that kind of put that idea in my head. An example I would give is maybe we'll have a dog doing a detection problem, and he comes in and he works it out just like any other dog would. And then some time passes and we bring him back out maybe an hour later, and he walks in the room. And if he doesn't have a good working memory, he acts like he's never been there before. And then the one that has a good working memory will go, "Oh, I know this game. These are productive, and I'm gonna go right to this spot because this paid me last time." And so it really is interesting to see that they all can be very effective, but there are definitely some that have much better working memories than others.
Yeah.
So I have in my little Dutch Shepherd that I have right now, I've been taking him into the room with the place board, and you know, after the first couple of days now, as soon as I walk into the room, even off leash, he's flying to the place board.
That's awesome.
You know, I like that.
That's where he gets paid. I haven't had a puppy in a long time, and he has been a great breath of fresh air for me to see him learn and see him pick up on these little things. And, you know, he's just not the crazy Dutch Shepherd or Malinois that you see. He's clear headed and focused, and, you know, he gets great because he's a puppy, but it's been a lot of fun to see that very thing. As soon as he sees the place board, he's getting there as fast as he can every time.
Yeah.
And his motivation is food, correct?
No, I correct him with a prong collar. Yeah. You know, I walk in with the room, and I just take a leash and just noose him, you know, so I can go from my office to the training area. And in the training area, I'm limiting, obviously, what's in there, even though it's a business. So there's some barking dogs, but nothing around him. And the only thing in the middle of the floor is the place board right now. And then, you know, of course, pretty soon I'll add something different, and we'll just keep moving on. But it's really been fun to see him. And the sessions are going. I've been recording them on my iPhone, so they're about, you know, 6 to 7 minutes each session.
Yeah.
So much learning is taking place every single time. It's so cool.
They do learn very rapidly as the young pups. There's a rapid growth and development in their brain, and they're building pathways. And then they never learn faster than they will as a puppy. It's like a child. If you think, look at a baby at 9 months, what do they know? And then compare that to a 4-year-old child or a 3-year-old child even. They can walk, talk, feed themselves, and most of them go to the bathroom, you know. I forget what age children use the bathroom, but I have 5 kids, I should remember. But
that was a long time ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, that what they learn in that time period, and then compare that to how much you'd learn between 52 and 55, say, or 23 and 26, the amount of the growth and the rate of learning in that early period is incredible. Incredible.
Yeah. I would not, until I actually saw it with my own eyes and then experienced it, would have not have given as much credence to the idea that spending that time teaching dogs brain games or how to solve little problems, would how much that would impact a dog later in life as you begin to teach new tasks.
Yeah.
You know, people tend to think about, well, I want my dog to be well socialized when it's a puppy, but the little bit of time that you can spend just teaching him through the use of, you know, clicker and some treats, getting him to do just insignificant things where he has to use his brain to get reward, certainly makes a smarter dog down the road.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to throw out a shameless pitch here. I have been training retriever puppies, developing retriever puppies, not so much training, but developing retriever puppies, early exposure, early experience for about 30 years. And I had a website up trainingretrieverpuppies.com. And I was giving the information away and sharing at seminars and all. And I've packaged it now, and it's From the Pup Up, Retriever From the Pup Up. And it's a process that shows taking a puppy from 7 weeks to about 16 weeks. And it's on pushpulltraininganddrive.com. There's a store there, and the it shows developing all the new things. We're working on force fetch and collar conditioning. We're going to come out with them. There is a collar conditioning program, but we're going to release a new one that's specifically for the field dogs. And we've done a lot of early detection with puppies, and we're going to develop a puppy product for detection dogs too, to show how you can get them jump started. And I think that retriever from the pup up, it shows lining, targeting, retrieving, basic obedience, skills that were helpful in any venue, really.
That's so awesome. And what's it called again, Pat? Some of that you cut out on my end. I don't know if it's my connection or yours, but I missed the website, because we'll post that in the show notes.
That'd be great. Thank you. The website is pushpulltraininganddrive.com. And that's a long one. But if you go to my name, patnolan.com, and then it says online courses, there's a link on from my website, patnolan.com, that'll take you to the store, and you can look at the courses. And if, you know, if somebody tries it and they don't like it, I'll send them their money back.
Okay.
So,
well, that's awesome. Great information. Thank you.
Good deal.
So, I know we always try to keep these to about an hour. You have any other questions for Pat? But I want to be respectful of your time. I know you're busy.
I don't think I have any more questions. I want to make sure that folks know how to get a hold of them, and we'll have that in the show notes as well. But I know that I thoroughly enjoyed the seminar that I attended. Are you still doing seminars?
I am. We're done. We do some retriever seminars. We've done a police department or two. Most of my seminars are with the military, but we were down with Georgia Canine again last year, and hopefully next year. In fact, we're leaving tomorrow. My wife and I were going to Vancouver Island. She's going to do an obedience training seminar, and the following week I do a retriever seminar there on Vancouver Island. So we're still actively doing seminars, yes.
That's great.
Nice.
Very good.
Well, I got to tell you, Pat, this is I've only paid for one person's course, and it's yours. So
wow. Thank you. Hey, that's high praise. Thank you.
Not that I'm anybody, man, but it's you are one of the people in the industry that I've respected from a distance and watched for many, many years. And I really appreciate what you're doing. And I really, really appreciate you coming on the show. I really do.
Well, thanks for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I hope we get a chance to train dogs together sometime.
Would love to. I would love to
make that happen.
Real good.
Very good. Well, hope
thanks,
you have a
guys.
Good rest of your day. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
For your time.
Thanks. Bye.
So, I don't know about you, however, that's somebody I wanted to talk to for a long time. Followed him around at a distance via social media and watching some things online, and really like what he does. Really like his dogs. What a knowledgeable guy. You know, when you can have someone on your show that can actually explain what they're talking about, that's a student of the profession. So it was a great episode. I love that.
Yes, for sure. He's not just blurting out buzzwords. He knows what he's talking about. He's been there, done that. Such a nice guy too. A lot of integrity. And anytime you get an opportunity to see him, either watch a video, but more importantly, if you get an opportunity to go see him speak or present, you owe it to yourself to do that, because he'll definitely open your mind.
Yeah, I don't know. When we had John Emler on our show a few episodes ago, he's was able to, with the the IACP that they're involved in, I guess, had him as a guest, and John was really, really impressed with what he did. Really, really a good story for him to see him as well. Thought it was really cool.
Very good. All right.
Well, this tonight may be a redo, right?
I think it may be.
If we've done this one before, but this is Buffalo Trace, and we've often said that Buffalo Trace has sold their soul to the devil, because they don't produce anything that's bad. It's a pretty delicious brand, so we won't bore you with the details. As always, my friend, here's to the hair of the dog that bit you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks so much, you guys, for following along, supporting us,
and listen to these wonderful conversations that Howard and I are just blessed to have each and every day. We'd like to thank and support all of our first responders, police, fire, EMS, and our military for once again holding the line, keeping us safe. Stay safe, brothers and sisters. We love you. God bless, and God bless America.